This is the Rise Up See Red podcast, all about the Arizona Cardinals and the NFL, featuring insider and outsider perspectives. Enjoy the best hour of Cardinals talk on the web. Now here are your hosts, Jess Root and Seth Cox.
Hello, Arizona Cardinals fans, and welcome to the latest edition of the Rise Up See Red podcast. This is episode 291, and I'm your host, Jess Root from CardsWire.com, the NFL wire site that covers the Arizona Cardinals from the USA Today. My co-host is Seth Cox from RevengeOfTheBirds.com, the Arizona Cardinals site for the SB Nation family of sites. And we get to talk about, finally, the Cardinals with a win. They come on coming off a 27-6 victory over 26-7 victory over the New York Giants. They move above 500, 7-6, get back in the playoff race. Seth, what... We looked at this game going into it. It was going to be tough, and it was not nearly as tough as we thought it was going to be, was it?
No, it wasn't, and that was kind of crazy because we looked at this game and just kind of where they were coming from, the New York Giants, and how well they had been playing. Let's be honest, Cardinals fans don't pay much attention to the New York Giants, and quite frankly, not many people have this season. But they have, the last, you know, about 7 weeks, they've been playing good football, including a 4-game win streak over that time. And they had some impressive victories in those games. And so you looked at it and you saw, you know, what was, I mean, that's the other crazy thing to think is, they win that game. The Cardinals and the Giants are literally tied record-wise. And so to come in and not just beat them, but completely dominate them on both, basically in all three facets of the game, a bit surprising on, because I think we didn't expect it to be so much of the running game, and instead expected to see a little more passing. But the Cardinals had a really balanced offense, a really good balanced offensive attack, and it ended up being kind of a cakewalk because of how well the defense and special teams played, making life easy for the offense where they didn't have to make, you know, big plays.
Yeah, absolutely. There was a lot to like out of that in that game, some historic type things. So we had some dominant performances. The pass rush was great. They took advantage of things. And we're going to talk about in this edition of the show, we're going to break down the best parts of the victory. We're going to talk about Hassan Reddick and his historic performance of five sacks between Daniel Jones and Colt McCoy. And we're going to talk about as well a change on the offensive line in the starting lineup. We'll discuss the playoff outlook for the Cardinals now, and as they're kind of back in the driver's seat. And then we'll look ahead to their Week 15 matchup against the Philadelphia Eagles, a team that has changed quarterbacks. Is there anything we can learn from their start again, from their game against Tua Tagovailoa, and apply that to the game this weekend against Jalen Hurts? Let's kick things off, Seth. So, Seth, obviously, there were things to like offensively and defensively. I think we have to talk about first and foremost, without talking about Hassan Reddick specifically, holy cow, the pass rush. We had gotten almost no production off the edge this for the past month, and that edge exploded. 8 total sacks. You got 5 from Hassan. You got 2 from Dennis Gardeck, who is, I don't have no idea how he is producing this year. He barely gets any defensive snaps, and he's got now 5 sacks on the season. Marcus Golden gets the early sack to get things going. They force a ton of fumbles, and Daniel Jones looked like the rookie Daniel Jones who couldn't hold on to the football.
Yeah, and it's one of those situations where we've talked about it. They haven't been healthy along the defensive line. And so I think the fact that they started to get a little healthy, and I won't say completely healthy because Jordan Phillips played 4 games or four snaps, sorry, in this game before re-injuring his calf, I believe it was, right? Yeah. And so you just, you look at it, and we've talked about this. I really do think that the struggle has been this inability to really get anything up front. They basically, offensive lines have been able to block one-on-one without any problems. And that's not a shot at Trevon Coley and who else was playing snaps in that.
McGee, Josh Morrow.
Yeah, I mean, just guys, no offense, but I mean, and so to get back Lecky Fotu and Zach Allen and Rashard Lawrence and then to be able to use Angelo Blackson in a more of the role that they envisioned him in as a 35-45% snap player, you know, I think it just makes such a difference, because when two or three guys can occupy four blockers, that leaves Hassan Reddick or Dennis Gardeck or Marcus Golden one-on-one, or, you know, if, for instance, the second play of the game, Marcus Golden completely unblocked, so he can just go smoke Daniel Jones. And you know, that just, I don't think people understand when you don't have a Chandler Jones, when you don't have a, you know, a Von Miller. I'm not going to say an Aaron Donald, because nobody has an Aaron Donald. But when you don't have, you know, these guys that are all pros, like a Jones, like a, you know, like one of the Bosa boys, you know, when you don't have guys like this that manufacture their own pass rush, you have to have four or five guys that demand attention. And all of a sudden the Cardinals got that back this week. And, you know, it opens things up for guys that maybe don't have the pass rush prowess, Gardeck and you know, Marcus Golden, but have the motor and the ability on, you know, two snaps in a game to outwork and outpower an offensive tackle. The other thing that I don't think people knew about the Giants coming in, and we talked a little bit about it last week. I don't think we talked quite enough about it, but we also didn't expect to see eight sacks in the game, is how well their pass blocking had been playing, and more specifically, how well Andrew Thomas had been playing. Andrew Thomas was one of the probably five best pass blocking offensive linemen in the NFL this season.
And that's he did have some struggles early on, but he right. bounced back nicely and became exactly what people thought he would be, a very solid. Now, we'll say this. Mekhi Becton came in this year and has been wow. But Andrew Thomas has been every bit as what you expected.
And you look at his games in this kind of win streak, and you know, I know they lost to Tampa in a close one, but he had a really good game against Tampa Bay, had a good game against Washington, who, I mean, we know how talented that pass rushing front is, had a good game against Philadelphia, who has a, you know, a stable of pass rushers, came back, had a really good game against a bad Cincinnati you know, pass rush. The Bengals don't offer a ton. But then last week against the Seattle Seahawks, he was borderline dominant. Probably his best game of the season. And you feel like, you felt like he was trending in the direction where you go, oh, okay, this guy's going to be a problem. And the Cardinals just absolutely obliterated him. I mean, he had by far his worst performance as a player in this game. I'm trying to find his overall stats. I don't know if you have them there, but I know he allowed a ton of hits and things of that nature.
Well, it's interesting. The Cardinals, what they did, and this is the other part. Their defense had their absolute best game. And there's one thing that they had to do, because the Giants run the ball extremely well. Not only do they run it well, they run it a lot. And that was one thing I was worried about entering this game, is because their run defense has been, you know, for lack of a better word, even at best. And so one of the things I was looking into in that game is the fact that, hey, if they're just going to be consistently moving the ball, and if you look at Wayne Gallman's stats, he ran the ball fine. The problem was, and this is when I previewed the game with Giants Wire's managing editor Dan Benton, he asked how the Cardinals are going to defend the run. That's the one thing I always worried about. And knowing that they don't defend the run great, the plan was, hey, they've got to score points. And so they did well enough early. They got a lead, and then the Giants couldn't run the ball anymore. And so it was the perfect storm. And so Vance Joseph entered that game. I think it really helped that they got their defensive line, their big defensive line in the back. Now, unfortunately, Jordan Phillips got hurt, but you got Lekki Fotu. He was fully healthy. Rashard Lawrence came in. Zach Allen actually looked like he was doing something last week, because the week before he played, we had the most defensive snaps among the defensive line and had no stats at all. And so they entered last week with the exception of Corey Peters and replacing with Domata Peko, a completely healthy, capable group of defensive linemen. And I'm sure that's what contributed to the pressure off the edge and led to Hassan, because Hassan Reddick had not had a sack in the previous five games. He had five in the first seven, no for five games, and then five against the Giants. And so, one, Vance Joseph's game plan was good. And Cliff Kingsbury admitted they could tell Daniel Jones wasn't 100%, and they took advantage of that. They could tell that he wasn't, that even the way he was throwing the ball, they knew that he was not, that the hamstring was still bothering him, because he wasn't, whether was he able to plant as confidently or push off as confidently. They said just even in warm-ups, he wasn't slinging the ball around. They took advantage of that. And, you know, for people who have been calling for Vance Joseph to be fired, I mean, let's give the credit where it's due.
Well, and it was one of those things that you and I have talked about. We've been open to giving him more time, knowing how banged up they were. The question was, as they got healthy, were we going to continue to use that? And you and I talked about that in their kind of struggle, the last couple of weeks defensively, when they were, you know, getting kind of worked over. And you know, they went through that stretch from the first Seattle game, and I think we were okay with their performance in the first Seattle game. But after that first Seattle game, Miami, you know, 34, Buffalo 30, Seattle again 28. And that's when we started to say, okay, this defense is becoming a problem, because they're not, I mean, if you are averaging 30 points a game or right around 30 points a game, you shouldn't be losing games. And they were 2-2 in those games. And then they came back and they had a really, you know, I would say a strong performance against the Patriots. They just had untimely lapses. But then they played against the Rams, and it just was another one of those games where it was like, okay, maybe they just aren't very good. I mean, that was clearly their worst defensive performance of the year. I know they gave up more yards in the Seahawks overtime win, but they also had three turnovers. You know, when you look at the game against the Rams, they gave up 463 yards and only forced one turnover. That game against the Rams was kind of actually really reminiscent of their performance against the Panthers, when we started to have those questions again. But if you kind of look at their MO, it's that they tend to struggle when they're not at 100%. And that was something we've talked about, you know, from the beginning of this season, is that they just lack depth at key positions. And they lack the ability to kind of play through injuries. And so as they're finally starting to get healthy, I think that they're in a better spot, and it's giving Vance more confidence to play into his schemes that he wants to use. And that's, I mean, that's one thing I think we can agree on, is that we haven't really seen what or who Vance is as a play caller. And so when you look at him this year, I don't want to get too high and say this is who he is, because you're not. I mean, this defensive performance was historically good. 159 yards of total offense, 3 turnovers, only the 1 touchdown drive all game.
Yeah. So and the only 159 total yards, and 75 came in that 1 drive.
Yeah, and so you don't want to, you know, you don't want to say this is who they are, but you also don't want to look at last week or the Panthers game and say this is who they are. So I think what we're waiting to see is what he's able to do consistently. I mean, just like people calling for Cliff Kingsbury's job after last week's loss to the Rams, I think that there are definitely times where you can look at those things. And I think, you know, one of the times that you and I would have said maybe they need to look at Cliff's job, it would be if they finish the season at, you know, 6-10. Losing, you know, 7 games in a row is difficult to overcome. And it's difficult to inspire. In the same way, if those final games you saw 6 or 7, you know, the final 5 games, if they were all similar to what we saw with the Rams, where teams are going over 400 total yards on offense against the Cardinals defense, and they're not creating pressures and turnovers, then I think you have something. But I think he had legitimate excuses for some games, and some games I just think that, you know, it's hard to stop good offenses. And so when you look at it overall, I think that Vance has done a good job, and he's created a defense that is effective. It still lacks talent, but they're able to scheme around that better than they were before.
Absolutely. And it helps, like, obviously this is a team built to succeed offensively, and then the defense can then thrive off that. And now early in the season, the defense carried the offense a little bit, but we had that 5-game stretch where they scored at least 30 points and had at least 400 yards of offense. Then in their 3-game losing streak, the graphic I saw on the television, I couldn't believe it. They're in those 3 games, they were 30th in the league in offense, in terms of they didn't gain more than 314 yards in any of those 3 games. And the offense, even though it, you know, against a good physical Giants defense, looked much more like the offense that we were used to. It stalled a couple times. They went for it on 4th down at the goal line again, and they didn't get it in. It didn't end up hurting them, but they put up 26 points, so they nearly got to their 30, and they probably should have had at least 29. They kicked the field goal in that one drive, and they had 390 yards. They were 395 before the kneel downs took it to 390, and so they were at those benchmarks of 30 points and 400 yards, which is kind of what you want to see from a high-end offense, which is what the Cardinals are supposed to have. They were nearly there, and it wasn't a great offensive performance. It was a good offensive performance, but it wasn't great, and they still nearly hit those benchmarks. And you saw good things. Kyler Murray ran the ball a little bit, so he got his legs involved, which, you know, maybe he's right and they don't need him to do that to be successful. But when he does, it sure does make things easier. Kenyon Drake had a solid game. He had 80 yards and a touchdown. He's now up to, he has a career high in over 850 yards so far this season. DeAndre Hopkins had a big game, 9 catches, 136 yards. So he was involved. You kind of had everything that you wanted. It just wasn't completely in sync. And you were doing this against a defense that had held the Seahawks only 12 points, had sacked Russell Wilson 5 times, that had forced turnovers, and the Cardinals were able to avoid that. So it was a great defensive performance and a good offensive performance, and I think that the defense was great because the offense was good, and it took the Giants out of what their strength was, that is taking care of the ball, running the ball effectively, and letting that defense do things, and they weren't able to do that. And I think that's kind of the recipe for the Cardinals' success against teams like this, is that, you know, they can overcome their lack of talent on defense if their offense is playing well, and their offense hadn't been playing well. It looks like, and I'm going to say this, is that Cliff Kingsbury claimed that the game plan didn't really change, the execution got better. And if you look at the early things that they were trying to do against the Rams compared to what they did against the Giants, that's probably correct. He didn't. We all saw that NFL, the next gen stats, you know, the route tree that DeAndre Hopkins ran against the Rams, and he was all on the left side, and it was all short stuff. Yes, that looked bad. Like, how are you only using DeAndre that way? Two things to consider. One, that only showed his catches and not every route that he ran. And Cliff Kingsbury admitted they scrapped the game plan and just went 2-minute for pretty much over a half of that game. And they were having success at it. But if you notice early in the game, Hopkins was lining up in the slot. I remember a couple of times he just didn't get targeted in those slots. And they moved him around again this past Sunday. And so it looks like with Kingsbury's scheme, you need things to be successful early, or to kind of get a rhythm, and then things work out. And that's kind of what happened. They scored some points early. They got some stops. And kind of like we'll go with any football team, once you get a lead, it's easy to play with a lead, especially when you have talent offensively.
Yeah, and that's the thing, is they've struggled to find consistent balance. But I wrote about this win, in particular how dominant the running game was in this win, because when you look at what the Giants have done the last, you know, 5 weeks in particular, but all season in terms of rushing defense, this was the most yards they've given up rushing all season. If you take out the final 3 kneel downs from Kyler Murray, which accounted for, you know, 3 carries and minus 5 yards, they had 40 carries for 164 yards rushing, the 1 touchdown. The next closest team in that is the 156 yards from the Eagles in a win. You know, over the 4-game winning streak, they'd allowed only just over 50 yards per game rushing. So when you look at what the Cardinals did in their game against what has become a really good Giants defensive front, I mean, their defense, I don't think gets enough credit. And you know, you look at a guy like Jabril Peppers and you see a similar type player to Buda Baker. You know, you look at Blake Martinez and you see what Cardinals fans had hoped that they were going to get out of Jordan Hicks, just kind of that tackling machine that's always around everything. And then their front with Dalvin Tomlinson, Dexter Lawrence, and Leonard Williams is incredibly, incredibly talented and ferocious. And to hold that team to 1 sack, to run for 164 yards and average over 4 yards a carry, it was really impressive. I wish I would have paid attention because I always forget about this. But coming out of that game, they're still seventh in the NFL in rushing yards allowed on the season. I mean, that's how good their run defense is. And the Cardinals basically dared them to stop it, and they couldn't.
It was nice. That's a fantastic point. It's they really did a good job on all fronts. They got good returns from Christian Kirk in the return game. Mike Nugent kicked and made all four of his field goals. Of course, it's not like we had issues with Zane Gonzalez on anything before 40 yards. He hadn't missed any of those all year. They got closer, and it was one interesting thing is that they knew that Cliff Kingsbury knew that Nugent doesn't have a great leg. He was in a position where I think it would have been a 53-54-yard field goal, and Cliff punted. I don't think there would have been any doubt he would have sent Zane out there because he's got the leg to do it. He sent him out for 54-yarders before. But they got a solid performance all the way around. That's all you can say. It was exactly what they needed to do. It breaks them out of that skid. I think it builds a little confidence, and it's the perfect timing because of what's coming up on their schedule and what was the time of year. They need to be playing good December football. Coming up next on the Rise of Sea Red podcast, the best hour of Cardinals talk on the way. Let's narrow it down and talk about Haason Reddick specifically. What do we think about his performance, and what do we expect from him moving forward, and is there still a future with the team? That's coming up next on Rise of Sea Red. We're back on the Rise of Sea Red podcast, the best hour of Cardinals talk on the web. Haason Reddick, of all the players to have a historic performance, it was Reddick. Marcus Golden got things started with a sack fumble, and then Reddick had a game for the ages. Set a Cardinals record, a franchise record for sacks in a game. Remember that Chandler Jones had 4 sacks against the Giants a year ago. Reddick not only matched that, he did him one better with 5. He sacked Daniel Jones 3 times. He got to Holt McCoy twice. Forced 3 fumbles. What? I can't think. No, this is the type of game that you just stand in awe of. And what can you say about that performance? Because that is, like, even great pass rushers don't have those games. I mean, Chandler Jones hasn't had a 5-sack game. He had 2 4-sack games, which was rare in and of itself. But what did you think about that Reddick performance? How surprised were you to see it?
I mean, obviously, anytime you're talking about historical performance, you're always surprised. I found the numbers 2 sacks and 5 hurries and 7 total pressures that Andrew Thomas gave up, and I would assume most of those were from Haason Reddick. And when you look at it from that perspective, I was a bit surprised because, just like I said, Thomas has played really well. Reddick's been in a funk. I mean, we talked about it, 7 weeks in between sacks. It's not that he's played poorly by any means, but it's one of those things that you and I have discussed about re-signing of Reddick is how much can you pay a guy that, and whether you buy into PFF grades or not, it doesn't matter. I don't want to get into that huge discussion, but when you look at his grades this season, and they kind of chart out, everything, and you look at the color schematics and you look at, the shades of green, he's only got 4 games where as a defensive player, he's graded out as a, above average defender. Since he became the full-time guy, he's only had 2 until this game. And so when you look at it from the perspective of, were you surprised? I think the answer is, yeah. I mean, that performance was mind-blowing in and of itself. But when you dig into the numbers and really dig into the numbers, it's even more incredible when you consider that from a snap total perspective, he played 47 snaps because the defense was only on the field for 49. From a pass rush perspective, he only rushed the passer 22 times. So that means basically 20% of the time he was getting, or sorry, just like 23% of the time he was going to get a sack every time he rushed the passer. That's like what you hope for in an all-pro season, in just in terms of total pressures on pass rushing snaps. Like 23% of pass rush snaps being converted into sacks is literally unheard of. So when you look at this game just from that perspective, and you understand that this wasn't the Dallas game where he had 36 pass rushes, or the, you know, the Seattle game or the LA game, you know, or the Buffalo game where he had 47 pass rushes. This was one of his least pass rush games. It was the least pass rush game he's had since becoming the full-time starter outside of New England. And he was that dominant. It's really unheard of.
What's interesting is the comments that he made is that, well, one, Marcus Golden said that heading into week 14, Reddick said he was going to get to the quarterback. He was going to finally, because he got in 5 weeks, five games with no sacks after having five in the first seven, which was, we talked about him. It's like, hey, let's get him signed already. And then the downfall, that just the drop in production made you wonder, wait, is he coming to earth? Is he going to be able to do this for a full season? Because he is the one thing that just we've said about him since the beginning. Now, while people can criticize the fact that the Cardinals tried to put him at inside backer, let's understand this. The entire league had him pegged for playing off the ball because of his size. He's built like an off the ball backer, you know, 6'2", 235. That's, you know, if we've talked about like the physical profile, the athletic profile that Vance Joseph likes in his inside linebackers, that's Hassan to a T. The problem was that he just never had he could rush the passer. But no one thought that he was going to be an edge player at the next level because he, frankly, doesn't have the body for it. And so there was no one to predict that. Now, once they gave him the opportunity, he saw a little production, his rookie, a little bit of production. Then last year, he got a little better. And then coming in this year, he got the same defensive scheme second year in a row. He was productive early. And you wondered if he was going to be able to hold up. I've always doubted whether he was going to be strong enough or good enough to play on all three downs. And you look at his play over the last 5 weeks, he's been playing almost every single snap. And then this past week, five sacks. So he's doubled his total. He's up to 10 for the season. The thing with what I look at is this. We've seen him be solid, five sacks in seven games. That's productive. We've seen him not get a sack at all for over a month, and then we've seen him get five sacks. What is the sort of production that would be reasonable for us to expect over the last three games? I don't think we can ever expect. I mean, we should never expect a five-sack game out of anybody because that just doesn't happen. Can we reasonably expect, you know, two, three more sacks in the final three games? Is that something that we should reasonably expect from Reddick at this point? And do you think that he's turned the corner in terms of his place in the league among pass rushers?
I don't think you can expect any more sacks. I won't be surprised if he gets any, but you look at who's left. San Francisco, Trent Williams is maybe, you know, the best left tackle in the division, maybe in the NFL. I mean, he's been fantastic this year. He really struggled against LA, that game. And then Phillies, you know, I don't know. I mean, we'll talk about Philly later, but I honestly don't even know what to expect from their offense at this point. So I can't say if he'll even get enough pass rush attempts. That being said, I think when you look at Hassan's ability and his gameplay, you've got a guy who has the ability to, like Dennis Gardette, come in and make plays in a short amount of time. And that's not to say I'm comparing the two, because Reddick has earned, you know, his stripes this year especially. But the reality is, this was by far his best game of his career. And really, it was one of his only, what I would say, great games as a starter since he's kind of moved into that role. And so that's what makes it tough, is I think, if anything, he's a guy that can be a pass rush specialist and come in and create havoc on, you know, 25 to 30 snaps a game, and if he rushes the passer 20 times. And I think he can be successful in that, where, you know, if he gets 300 to 350 pass rush snaps in a season, he could be, because he's productive enough, I think, and athletic enough, I think he could be the type of guy that gives you that 7 to 12 sack range. I know that's a big range, but sacks typically come in bunches, as we're seeing. You know, he had, what, 5 his first...
5 in four, the first 7.
Yeah, 5 in the first 7, and then 5 and 1. So, I mean, you kind of... And he had 2 against Dallas and 1 against Seattle. So basically, I mean, this is how his sacks have gone this year. He had 1 against Washington, 1 against Detroit. So that's week 2 and 3. Then he had 2 against Dallas and 1 against Seattle. So now you're at 5. And then it was, you know, 7 weeks until he had 5 again. So he's got a lot of zeros in the sack column. And that's kind of what it kind of breaks down to, is I think from a skill perspective, I don't know if he's done enough to be like, hey, yeah, you're a $15 million a year edge player. But I do think he has the skill set and the ability, and he's shown that he doesn't need 50 pass rush snaps a game, you know, or 40 pass rush snaps a game to create, be an effective pass rushing defensive player.
It's kind of interesting, because we've talked about, hey, you could take him and give him a Devon Kennard contract, the 3 years, $20 million, and that might be a nice little sweet spot. You see, he hits the 10 sack mark, though, and you're like, how much is his price going to go up? And then you see what happened with Marcus Golden last offseason. He had 10 sacks, and he didn't really get anything in the market and had to come back on that you know, that free agents return to team tag type thing that gives him $5 million. So that you look at that and you're wondering, well, what type of free agent is he going to be when you got 10 sacks, you had 5-1 game? What sort of attention is he going to garner? And I think part of it is he's not going to garner attention from everyone, because while we had doubts that he could play outside backer in this scheme, there's no way he can play defensive end at, you know, 6'2", 6'1", and 235. And so the only teams that are going to give him some looks are 3-4 teams who have that need. But I think he is playing himself into a lucrative deal, although he still might be in the right price range for the Cardinals. Couldn't you see him being Chandler Jones pair on the field? I think he gives you even... Now, Devon Kennard, he gives you a little more. He's really strong in the run game, but we've seen his playing time has really decreased. You give him, you're giving Chandler Jones a more athletic pair on the other side, but someone who's, and he can drop in coverage. In fact, his coverage play is much better, coming off the edge, peeling off against backs. He's looking better in coverage than he's ever done, and he's not bad against the run. He hasn't been bad against the run. He's been solid and kind of across the board. do you think that now he's expressed in an interview with a guy who did an interview with him for my site that he really wants to come back. He wasn't super comfortable talking about the contract situation. I wanted to find out if they've already had those talks. Not sure if that has happened or not, but I think that game might have pushed him perhaps out of kind of the budget the Cardinals might have for that position.
Yeah, it's always tough. I mean, it's tough when a guy plays well in a contract year and you're already kind of cash-strapped as is. I think depending on what they're able to do with Devon Kennard and Marcus Golden kind of speaks to it. I think they'd like to bring Golden back. I think they'd like to cut Kennard because I think there's got to be more to the story on Kennard, right? I mean, you would expect at least. I mean, it's weird. It's
might
weird.
Simply
that
just be that
he just doesn't fit what they want
to
do.
Or when he got hurt, he kind of had the David Johnson thing happen. So they go out and get a guy in Marcus Golden, who gets a little hot, and they just like what he does a little bit more.
And so, you know, you look at it, I think, I'm trying to look right now for Kennard. Potential out 1 year. So just so if they cut him this year, they have an out after this year, they're only going to lose $3.75 million in dead cap space. They'll gain back, you know, they'll gain back some of that. So, I don't know what their budget's going to be like. I don't think you're going to get them. I don't think you're going to be able to sign Reddick to what you signed Kennard to, and I think that's kind of what they're looking for. I don't think you can franchise tag him because I don't think you can afford to pay $35 million for Reddick and Chandler Jones, especially at coming off an injury, Chandler Jones. So it will be interesting. I think you can probably get him on a cheaper kind of 2 or 3 year deal if you wanted to go that route. But I don't know if that's exactly what they're looking for either right now.
Coming up next on the Rise of C-Red podcast, episode of Cardinals Talk of the World. Let's talk. Move on and talk about a change on the offensive line. Justin Murray now a starter. What does that mean? That's coming next on the Rise of C-Red. We're back on the Rise of C-Red podcast, the best of Cardinals Talk on the web. We noticed something in the starting lineup on Sunday that kind of got glossed over a little bit, but now it also looks more official with the depth chart. Justin Murray is now the starting right guard, no longer J.R. Sweezy. We felt that J.R. Sweezy had probably been their worst lineman of the group this year. We felt like when Murray was in there, when Sweezy was out, they were playing a little bit better offensively, got a little bit better. And it appears that the Cardinals feel the same way. Are you surprised that Murray was given? I didn't expect, personally, I did not expect him to overtake Sweezy before the end of the year. I think kind of Sweezy has the mentality that they like. The game on Sunday was the first time he had played in a game and hadn't started since week 15 of his rookie season. He's always been a starter. After his rookie season, he started every single game he's ever played in. Look at his career. He's not been great. He's been solid. He's not been bad. But I thought they would just rotate them in like they did last year with Mason Cole. And then Sweezy would leave in free agency quietly, and Murray would be given the opportunity to compete for a starting job. It clearly shows that they believe in Murray enough now that they're going to make the move, give him the playing time, and I'm really intrigued to see how this goes for the next couple of games because, you know, we talk about QB wins, we're talking right guard wins. The Cardinals are 3-1 when he starts at right guard.
Yeah, and I think Sweezy's only upside that he brings, and you and I have, I think, talked about this. I don't know if we talked about it on the air before, but his biggest upside is that you kind of hit on is he's that alpha. He's that kind of, obviously not to the same extent, but kind of that nasty Richie Incognito type of player that they just don't have. And so I think when you're able to have that type of player, it's good, but it's only good when they're playing at a high enough level to that kind of machoism stuff works in that sense, if that makes any sense. So, you know, if they're just getting penalties because they're, you know, sprinting down the field and hitting somebody late, or, you know, they're playing on the edge of dirty, they don't bring anything to the team if they're not playing at a consistently high level. And let's be honest, Sweezy, like you said, for his career, doesn't typically play at a consistently high level, but he hasn't at all this year for the Cardinals. So I think it makes it a little easier to make that move when you talk about a Justin Murray, and that he's kind of been a, like you said, a Cougs favorite. He's a guy that they trust. He's a guy that does what he's asked to do, and he does it at a high level. And that's, you know, like I said, that's kind of the opposite of what Sweezy was. Sweezy is kind of that enforcer type that you definitely need, but you only need it if the offense is playing at a high level, and he brings, that's his, you know, that's his niche that he brings and fills. It doesn't do any good when you're, you know, struggling on offense and that guy behind you, even though he might be nicer and you know, not play with that same edge, he actually is the better player.
It really is amazing. To this day, if there's a move that the Cardinals have made, if you look at any of the Steve Keim moves, this is the one where you look at and you're like, wow, he nailed this. Because Justin Murray had played in two games his entire career. I believe he played on five or six previous teams in three seasons in 3 years. You know, he was a classic, you know, camp type body or just fringe journeyman who is sticking around barely in the league. But even you date back to when they claimed him off waivers, the first interview that Steve Keim gave on the radio, he was excited about Justin Murray. He thought he talked about the upside that he has, not only at tackle, as at guard. So if there's one thing that we've ever said about Steve Keim, the offensive line has been tough for him, receivers been tough with him, they absolutely nailed Justin Murray, because he played all right for them, right tackle, and as the season went on, it went well. They talked about, now, obviously, when they did not see him as their right tackle or starting right tackle moving forward after they brought back Marcus Gilbert, as they drafted Josh Jones, they didn't have plans for him to play tackle, right tackle. But to move him inside to guard, extend that contract, you can't help but root for a guy like that, because that's one of these stories, that a guy that, you know, bounced between five different teams, was claimed off waivers, and then just does everything right. It's fantastic to see, and in terms of managing the cap, if you get starter quality snaps out of Justin Murray, I know his max over the next 2 years is $9 million. It's really kind of a two and a, it's about 2 years, $6 million is what the actual money looks like. That is fantastic in terms of managing the cap, especially when you got Mason Cole on one at center. You've got Lamont Gilliard that you've liked. And so you don't have to pay a ton of money. You've got DJ making big money. You've got Justin Pugh making good money. And then the rest of the offensive line, you're kind of got it on the budget. And this is a move that surprised me, because I thought it would just be for next year. But by giving him reps at guard now as a starter, you're going to make him better for next year, just based on what we've seen from him, how he approaches football, how he really takes to Sean Coogler's coaching, and just the way that his teammates respect him.
Well, and, you know, the biggest thing with offensive line that we talk about quite a bit is this camaraderie. And it really is, because especially in today's NFL, it's just such a tough position to play. It's a tough position to find talent at. And when you look at a team like the Cardinals, the key to their success over the next three seasons, outside of just, you know, the obvious things of like Kyler Murray continuing to develop and things of that nature, the key to the success is going to be finding those kind of hidden gems, those guys that make the difference for the team, but do so at a budgeted, friendly cost. And the Cardinals, let's be honest right now, they don't have that, or they haven't had that very much. You know, obviously they just paid Buda Baker a ton of money. You know, you talked about the DJ Humphreys contract, those type of things. You know, that's typically the players that the Cardinals, and rightfully so, expect the most from. And to get, and I don't want this to come out the wrong way, so I'm not saying this to be rude, but to get average to above average play at backup price is such a massive thing, because what that's going to allow the team to do, especially these next couple seasons, is now overpay or swing for the fence on a guy like a, you know, it hasn't worked out, so, you know, maybe this isn't the greatest example, but now you can swing for the fence on a guy like Jordan Phillips or Devon Kennard. You know, you can be a little bit more aggressive on guys that you look at and go, hey, maybe they don't deserve the money, but this is, like you said, the way I'm going to get them. And so if I get them in and it works out, you know, we're in a good spot. If it doesn't work out, it's a no harm, no foul type of thing, because I've got a guy like Justin Murray who I don't have to worry about. I've got a guy, you know, I've got a guy like Kyler Murray on a rookie contract still, so I can afford to take some risk. And the thing that you hope is that those risks pay off, because and Justin Murray, you know, makes the Cardinals a better team, but it also gives the Cardinals a better chance to be successful in their future.
Coming next on the Rise of Seared podcast, the best hour of Cardinals talk on the web. Let's move on and talk about their playoff outlook. They've regained the seventh wild card seed, the seventh seed in the NFC. Can they control it? What does the outlook look now? That's coming up next on Rise of Seared. We're back on the Rise of Seared podcast, the best hour of Cardinals talk on the web. Cardinals are back in the playoff picture after a week in which they fell out of it. They went 6-6. The Minnesota Vikings overtook them. They, with a win over the Giants, either way, the Cardinals were going to be back into the playoff picture, because the Vikings and the Tampa Bay Buccaneers both played each other. Assuming one team wins, the Cardinals were going to leapfrog somebody. The Bucs beat the Vikings. The Vikings are now 6-7. The Cardinals have a full game lead on both the Vikings and the Chicago Bears. Once again, they're back in the driver's seat with a pair of very winnable games coming up, and making it look like if they win these next two games, they're probably in. Now, one thing that's a little bit trouble, I know Minnesota holds the common games tie break. I think the Bears do too. So they have to stay ahead of both those teams. Otherwise, they will get bumped. Now, Minnesota, say there's three teams that end up 9-7. Chicago already gets bumped because Minnesota holds, as of right now, and I think they still play one more time, but if Minnesota sweeps them, then I guess they wouldn't all finish 9-7. That would be impossible. But basically, the Cardinals need to stay where they're at. I don't know how easy it's going to be to move up, but I think they're in a position now that they got off the schneid there. They win the game against the Giants. They beat the Eagles. That gets them to 8-6. And that gives you, pick one game out of two. It would be obviously the easiest way would be to do it against the 49ers, because that Rams team, while they sometimes throw up and have some eggs, of, you know, lay an egg on the field every once in a while, that team looks as complete as any team right now. So this next two-game stretch for me is critical. Obviously, it starts with the Eagles, but you feel like 9 wins gets you in, 8 wins won't. I just feel that that's how it's going to be. But it's good to have them back in the driver's seat, to back over 500. It puts them, as we've talked about all year, they're now on schedule. Okay, they're on schedule again in terms of being in the playoffs. They're not ahead of schedule like they were earlier. They're not behind schedule, which is where they were for the first time last week. This puts them back on schedule, which is, you know, in terms of the expectations, is where you want them to be.
Right, and you know, this, you know, if they don't make the playoffs, and this is something we'll cover, you know, in depth at the end of the season, if they don't make the playoffs. But if they don't make the playoffs, they only have themselves to blame, and the big losses are going to be against two teams that aren't even in playoff contention, against, you know, with the Carolina Panthers and the Detroit Lions. I mean, those are going to be the games that you look back and go, man, that's where they blew it. And
for me, it's not even those two games. It's the Lions and the Patriots, because...
I just meant from a tiebreaker perspective.
True that. And, yeah, losing those NFC games were bad.
Yeah, you never want to lose games. And, yeah, we'll look at the Miami loss, we'll look at the New England loss and go, oh, man, kicks away from at least being in control in those games. But from a tie-breaking perspective, you're going to go back and you're going to go, why did you have to lose to bad NFC teams? I mean, it's one thing if you lose to the Bucs or the Saints. It's one thing if you lose to the Packers, maybe even the Vikings. But, yeah, to lose to the Lions, who are going to finish last in the NFC North, and the Panthers, who are fighting with the really bad Atlanta Falcons to finish last in the NFC South, that's going to be where it just hurts, because the way the tiebreakers work, you know, obviously there's no head-to-head with those teams this year, and the common opponent's record, the Bears already have the better record.
And I think both Minnesota and Chicago clinched it. There's no way, because the Cardinals are 1-2 against their common opponents, and I think Chicago is 3-1, or maybe 3-2, and Minnesota
3-2, yeah.
And Minnesota's, what are they, 2-2?
I think they're 2-2 with a chance to get to 3-2. So yeah. So I mean, you know, in the end, that's where you'll lament those losses. But yeah, I mean, overall, they're back on the schedule we were hoping they would be on. They're back to, you know, as cliche as it sounds, controlling their own destiny for the playoffs, which is what we've talked about has been the goal for this team. Like, you don't have to make the playoffs. That wasn't, I mean, obviously that's always the goal, but the expectation wasn't, oh, you make the playoffs or you've had a bad season. But when you started to control your own destiny, it started to matter, because you're now almost like in a game, you're playing from ahead, and how do you respond to that? And then the next thing is, when it starts to get tough or adversity starts to show up, how do you respond to that? I think this was their first clear response to adversity of like, hey, we can come out of this on our own. Like, we can get back in the saddle and really kind of put pressure on teams. And they did that this week. And I think, you know, they're in the long run, I look at all of this as a building year, because I just don't see this team being able to, even if they get into the playoffs, which I think they will at this point, I don't know if they have the horses to compete, you know, with
New Orleans or Green Bay.
Yeesh. Yeah, who they're going to play in the first round. And that's not a bad thing. I mean, that's not a bad thing, is, you know, because obviously they have both of those teams have Hall of Fame quarterbacks. And then you look at how good and how much those teams have been investing in veteran talent. Whereas the Cardinals, a lot of their talent is young and still learning. So, but to be able to compete with them on in the playoffs, I mean, that's just that's to have the chance to compete with them is the start kind of we were or the finale of what we were hoping to see this year, and now they're a little closer to that.
Coming up next on the Rise Up Sea-Red podcast, the best star of Cardinals to talk about this. Move on for the final segment. Talk about the game against the Philadelphia Eagles this weekend. Can they win it? How will they win it? What can we learn from their in it as they play Jalen Hurts now in his second NFL start that they might have gotten from when they played Tua Tagovailoa? That's coming up next on Rise Up Sea-Red. We're back on the Rise of Sea-Red podcast, the best star of Cardinals talk on the web. Let's talk about these Philadelphia Eagles, who had been on a really bad streak. They'd lost four in a row. They come up with a big win over the New Orleans Saints with a new quarterback in Jalen Hurts. Let's talk about Hurts first. He gives Philadelphia, even though Wentz is the same kind of athletic and mobile, Jalen Hurts with his running ability gives the Eagles the same sort of dynamic that the Cardinals have with Kyler Murray. And if you kind of look in parallels, this is the second time this season the Cardinals have gotten a rookie quarterback in their second start. Last time they got Tua Tagovailoa, and his second start, and he ripped them apart. Now, granted, I will say there was a little bit different context. They were down a lot of cornerbacks. But he still played very well against them. They get Jalen Hurts this time. The defense looks at the we'll see what happens with the injury report, but it appears that they were in a good place with their defense overall. How do you think they do against Hurts this time, who is a greater running threat and a different type of runner than Tua Tagovailoa?
I think that the Eagles present an interesting kind of dynamic. Their offense, you know, has not been good. So they made the switch. Their defense isn't bad. I mean, I don't think it's good by any means, but it hasn't been bad right now. And so when you look at what they bring, they're going to bring, you know, they're going to bring a different offense than what we've seen for most of the season. I think you're going to see a good defense that's going to put up a little bit more of a fight than what we saw this last week from the Giants. And that's going to be the interesting part to kind of watch is what they do defensively against the Cardinals. Because they have some talent along the defensive front, but their secondary is not great.
And decimated, too, because they lost Roddy McLeod for the rest of the year. Avante Maddox will miss this game. Darius Slay is in concussion protocol. We'll see if he comes out of there.
And he hasn't been good this year either,
no.
Darius Slay. So, you know, that's going to be the interesting thing is because you've got a dynamic. They're a little bit defensively, and they're not quite as good, but they're a little bit defensively like the Washington football team was, where they really rely on that dynamic pass rush to set the tone. And that pass rush hasn't been really on for the last couple of weeks. And that's why,
they did have a couple of guys with two sacks each last week.
And I meant before this last game. Sorry, I should have clarified that. Before this last game, that pass rush just had not been Fletcher Cox kind of looked like he had lost a step. Josh Sweat and Brandon Graham and Derek Barnett were not playing at the high level. And then they come into this game against this last game when they beat New Orleans and they played better. And it was, I get that it's New Orleans with Taysom Hill and it's not Drew Brees and things of that nature, but the defense, kind of started to come together. Barnett had a good game. Sweat had a good game. Javon Hargrave is a guy you and I both like quite a bit. He had a nice game. You know, and so they're going to bring a number of defensive linemen in and kind of rotate that and then force you to adjust. The players that they can pick on, I think, are really in the secondary, as you said, as it's kind of decimated, and then in their linebacker course. I am a Duke Riley fan, but he hasn't been, you know, great this year. And then I don't know who these other guys are that are playing linebacker for them, if I'm being completely honest.
And then you look at offensively, that offensive line has just, I mean, they didn't give up any sacks against the Saints. But Carson Wentz had been sacked a league high 50 times in 11 games. And so pass protection has been an issue this year. And then they lost their right tackle, their rookie right tackle, Jack Driscoll. They've already lost Jason Peters, Lane Johnson, Andre Dillard. That team has just had to shuffle offensive linemen in and out of the lineup. And then you look at what the Cardinals did against the Giants. You kind of expect them. You can't expect 8 sacks, but you should be able to expect them to rattle Jalen Hurts. But the problem is, it's his mobility, and he can hurt you with his legs, which he did. He did against the Saints, and so it'll be kind of critical to see how they do that, because you look at the Cardinals should have a significant advantage coming off the edge, and they should have a significant advantage against that secondary. The difference is going to be whether or not they can establish, because we have to, if they establish the run, they're going to be doing just fine. So can they move the ball on the ground to then open up that passing game and then attack down the field? And then it won't matter what the Eagles can do with the run game, because they won't be able to rely on it. And they ran the ball a lot. They had both both their running back and their quarterback over 100 yards rushing, which was, you know, Miles Sanders had a great game, Jalen Hurts had a great game. And so you allow the Eagles to do that, you're going to give them some success. If the Cardinals can limit that, they don't have a good rush defense, but if they limit the opportunities they have, there you go. They should be able to beat them. And but based on the fact that they kind of had an easy time against Washington early in the year, 30 points, and it really looked sort of effortless, they should be able to do the same thing against this Eagle defense.
Yeah, and that's going to be the key. And then offensively, I think you kind of hit it on the head. They have to be able to stop Miles Sanders. That's really, I mean, Jalen Hurts had a good game, so I don't want to take anything away from him. But he's still, you know, in his second start, so he's still got quite a bit to prove. You know, similar to Kyler Murray, when you talk about just playing at a high level over a sustained period of time. I would hope, I'm not going to say expect, I would hope that even though Kyler and Hurts played differently stylistically, that having Kyler in the organization should help them a little bit in terms of understanding how to contain a player like Jalen Hurts. And I think if you get Hurts into having to throw the ball consistently, that plays into your hands and gives you a really, really solid chance of winning the game. The biggest issue, as always, is can they stop Miles Sanders? Can they force Jalen Hurts to beat them? If Hurts beats you with his arm, you tip your cap. I mean, at the end of the day, that's all it is. Kind of like Tagovailoa did. If Tua beats you with no running backs and, you know, iffy at best wide receivers, then you tip your cap and you go, hey, wasn't our day. And, I mean, I know we talked about it and we'll always, you know, come back to they should have won that game. They should have beat the Dolphins, but at the same time, they did what they wanted. They forced a rookie quarterback to beat them, and he just did. And sometimes that happens. Sometimes your game plan of, hey, don't let Miles Sanders beat you. Make Jalen Hurts beat you. And then sometimes they do. And that's the beauty of the NFL, is you can go in with a great game plan and say, hey, this is our plan. Like, we're not going to let Jalen Hurts' legs beat the Cardinals. We're going to make Jalen Hurts' arm. And then he makes throws and plays, and then you go, hey, you know, like I said, you tip your cap and you say, that's what we wanted them to do. They did it. You know, we obviously were wrong. And you'd rather be wrong in your game plan and preparation than come in and go, oh, no, you know, we know that we're going to have to stop the pass. And you go, no, they haven't been able to throw the ball successfully in what feels like 2 years. Why, you know, invite them to throw the football and then make plays on it. If they're able to do that, and then, like I said, Hurts makes plays, and, you know, you tip your cap and you go, hey, we were wrong. We schemed wrong, and he just beat us. He was the better player today. But you can't let Hurts the runner and Miles Sanders dictate the pace of this game, and because they'll not only dictate the pace, they'll dictate the outcome.
What do you think happens in this game? When I wrote my preview for this first Sports Weekly, I felt pretty confident that after it looked like they got things back on track offensively against the Giants, that they would also, and thinking back to what they did against Washington, I think that they're going to be able to do that again. And I have them hitting that 30-point 400-yard plateau that they had during their extreme success, let's be honest. And I think they do that again. And so I think they have a little bit of problems defensively, but I don't think it'll matter because the offense will keep them ahead. I've got them winning this game 31-21.
And you would hope after the performance the defense had, even a 17-20 point, you know, giving up below their season average would be enough. And I think that's what you have to hope for, is that it is enough and they're able to take advantage and make Jalen Hurts have a couple errors, keep him contained in the run game and do a good job, you know, containing Dallas Goedert and Jalen Reagor, really their only two weapons. Travis Fulgham's been a nice story, don't get me wrong, but I mean, at the end of the day, you want Travis Fulgham to beat you over a guy like Miles Sanders. So I think that they come out and they win this game. They guarantee an 8-8 record, at worst a .500 season for the first time since 2017, and that they have a really good chance to finish with a winning record and find themselves in the playoffs in week 16 and 17, and that's really all you can hope for. I see something similar to 28-20.
Awesome. And with that, we will end this edition of the Rise of Sea Red podcast, the best of Cardinals talk on the web. Hopefully when we meet again in a week from now, that we will be talking about a team that's won another game, is on a two-game winning streak with a chance with one win away from a playoff berth. So on that note, let's wrap this show up. That's Seth Cox. I'm Jess Root. Thanks for listening as always. We'll be back again next week.
Thanks for listening to the latest edition of the Rise Up Sea Red podcast. Listen to previous episodes and subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher Radio, Audioboom, or many other podcast platforms so shows are delivered directly to your mobile device. Please give the show a 5-star rating and always support the sponsors who support the show. We'll be back soon for the best hour of Cardinals talk on the web. Rise up, Red Sea, be Red Sea Red, and of course, Rise Up Sea Red.